himself and Timothy. The two bearded soldiers, a Corporal Winslow and a Corporal Carey with the U.S. Army, had been on their way to Outpost Boston to help when they were hit by an IED and then ambushed by collaborators who had taken off after the attack. Their fatigues were covered in dust, oil, and the blood of their brothers. When the corporals finished explaining what had happened, Ruckley gave a rundown of their journey from Outpost Portland and the intel on Mount Contadin.
"A nuke," said Corporal Carey. "No way the collaborators have a nuke."
"I saw it with my own eyes," Timothy replied. "I was a prisoner at Mount Contadin."
"Fuck," said Corporal Winslow.
"I have to radio this in," Ruckley said.
"Yeah," Winslow said.
She picked up the receiver and dialed the encrypted channel for command. She got through to a comms officer and used her authentication codes to finally reach Lieutenant Festa. Once she had him on the line, she relayed the intel. Finally, Timothy felt some real consolation that they might have actually succeeded. But his mission wasn't over. Not until he was sure the collaborator base was destroyed.
"We need evac," Ruckley said to Festa. His response wasn't surprising.
"I'm sorry," Festa said. "I'm not sure that will be possible right now."
There wasn't any to give. It was too dangerous with the bats and other anti-aircraft weapons the collaborators had, and the military was running low on aircraft. They couldn't even confirm if they were able to attack the collaborator base. Ruckley stepped back out when the line went dead. All the relief Timothy had felt melted away. Had things gotten so bad that command couldn't even authorize an attack on a damn nuclear silo? Maybe they didn't believe his intel, or maybe they really were worse off than he'd thought. Or maybe they were afraid to announce their plans over the open channel in case the collaborators overheard. He hoped it was the latter. Still not knowing worried Timothy.
"The hell are we going to do?" Winslow asked.
"We ain't got nowhere to go," Carey said.
"We do have somewhere to go," Timothy said. "And we've got a truck to get us there." Ruckley and the other two soldiers both looked at him. "We have to make sure that base is destroyed," Timothy said. "Stock up on weapons and ammo and give me some NVGs. We're going in dark and fast." President Ringgold finished off another cup of coffee in the temporary CIC within the offices of the 9/11 Memorial Museum. The chatter of officers coordinating defensive operations, triage, and other outpost duties buzzed alongside computers and radios. At nearly 2 a.m, this was her fourth cup, and so far the caffeine had done little to assuage the suffocating grasp of exhaustion. But at least she had some. Coffee, like bullets and people, were in short supply. Of the original 5,000 people who had come to shelter in the walls around the memorial outpost, there were only 4,000 left, all holed up in the buildings within the final defenses. Their only saving grace was that they hadn't been hit by another attack after the bats. The streets around the outpost were silent, and their remaining brave warriors were watching the darkness for monsters. It wasn't just trained professionals that had answered the call of duty. Fisher was one of many civilian volunteers on guard tonight, sitting in his truck, watching for enemies underground. And soon, Captain Reed Beckham, Master Sergeant Horn, and Sergeant Rico would arrive in the stealth helicopter from their mission in Denver. She prayed the quiet lasted, but her gut told her the variants were planning something for tonight. Commander Amber Massey sat at the head of the table next to her communications team. She looked up when an officer came in with a sit-rep.
"Fisher still hasn't detected any tunneling variants or other subterranean variant activity," said the officer.
Massey simply nodded. Next came Dr. Lovato's assistant, Ron. A soldier assigned to Sergeant Wynn's team accompanied him.
"How are things going down there?" Ringgold asked.
"A bit crazy," Ron said. "Kate connected to the variant network using the webbing."
"Connected how?" Ringgold asked.
"With her body," Ron said.
"What?"
Ron nodded.
"Good news is it worked. She stopped an attack on Danbury and prevented others. Judging by the signal activity, we're optimistic that things are going in our favor."
Ringgold didn't exactly celebrate. She didn't like Kate playing with fire, especially when she was using her own body.
"Tell Kate to be careful,"
Ringgold said. I don't want her taking any unnecessary risks by tapping into the network.
Understood, Ron said.
He slipped away with the soldier. Soprano came in from the other room with a piece of paper. Ringgold prepared for more news, but found herself thinking more about Kate and what she was doing down there. She prayed the doctor wasn't going to sacrifice herself.
Just got this from Vice President Lemke, Soprano said. It's a list of outposts reporting no contact with hostiles tonight.
Danbury, Providence, Allentown, and Freehold, Ringgold said. Ron's right. Their plan is really working. They're convincing the variants to stop attacks. Let's hope it holds for us, too, Massey said.
Ringgold scanned another list of outposts being evacuated.
Civilians are being flown out, driven out, or escaping in boats where they can, Soprano said. Everything is going as planned. Most are on their way to Texas and Florida, but some are being taken to the classified location where Vice President Lemke and the fleet have been transferred.
Only a few people knew about the location Ringgold had chosen, Puerto Rico.
Soprano, get me General Cornelius on an encrypted call, she said.
Yes, Madam President, Soprano said.
He pushed a conference phone into the middle of the table and dialed in the direct command number for General Cornelius. One of his officers answered. Ringgold requested to speak to the general. She didn't wait long before his grizzled voice sounded over the phone.
President Ringgold, good to talk to you,
Cornelius said.
And you, General. I'll get right to it. What's the status of the SDS equipment?
I'm moving the functioning equipment from Canada. As soon as the sun rises, it'll be on its way to the outposts you noted for protection.
Ringgold was relieved to hear that. She would have ordered the movement earlier, but the air threats made it too much of a risk. And with other outposts under attack, there simply wasn't any way to get it installed.
I have good news, too, Ringgold said. Our science team's efforts to disrupt some of the variant attacks seems to be working.
Ringgold continued the conversation to coordinate how they were going to share the strategies with Cornelius. The general was still holding on to Galveston with his forces, and they could use the break from attacks as much as the people Kate had helped. But before they could settle on logistics, Soprano returned to the room with a satellite phone.
President Ringgold, I'm very sorry to interrupt, but I just got an urgent call, Soprano said. It's from General Souza, and he says it's an emergency.
Her heart thudded.
General Cornelius, I have to go. I'll contact you again as soon as I can, Ringgold said.
Good luck,
he said. You too.
She ended the call, and Soprano handed her the phone.
Talk to me, General, she said.
Madam President, I got a credible report that the collaborators have a nuclear warhead mounted on a ballistic missile at Mount Katahdin in Maine, he said. We have reason to believe they're planning to use this nuke in the near future.
Everything around Ringgold seemed to fade into the background when she heard those words. The urgent chatter, the noise of footsteps on the tiled floor, the odor of smoke still hanging in the air. None of it stood out to her now that the words nuclear weapons resonated in her mind. Souza went on to explain the history of the facility and the ominous threat they now faced.
My God. We have to stop them, Ringgold said.
You need to get out of here and take the science team with you, Massey said.
What?
Ringgold asked, still partly in shock.
The collaborators could erase an entire outpost at any given moment, Massey continued. If they find out you and the science team are both here, where do you think they're going to launch that nuke?
Ringgold stood, feeling lightheaded. Just when she thought the nightmare couldn't get worse, it did.
As soon as Beckham arrives, we'll retrieve the science team and depart for command, Ringgold said.
Massey nodded, and Soprano assembled the Secret Service agents. By the time they were outside, a helicopter was already touching down.
That must be Captain Beckham, Ringgold said.
She jogged away from the 9/11 Memorial Museum. To help mask their position from threats, they had turned off all the floodlights and spotlights around the interior of the outpost. But with the still glowing embers of the burning oaks and the moonlight, they had enough light to guide them towards the open lawn where a helicopter sat on the charred grass, blades winding down. From out of the side door, Captain Reed Beckham limped toward her with Master Sergeant Parker Horn beside him. A group piled out of the chopper next, none of whom Ringgold recognized. Several of them had their arms tied behind their backs.
Madam President, Beckham said, saluting.
She saluted back, looking at the improvised prosthetic he wore.
Are you okay?
I'm fine.
Commander Massey stepped up, and Beckham gestured toward the group behind him.
We have people that need immediate medical attention. It's a long story, and we're not quite sure if they're friend or foes yet.
Beckham pointed toward a skinny older man and a Marine.
These two are definitely friends. They're the only reason we made it back here. They'll need all the medical attention you can spare.
Massey gave orders, and a few of her people ran over to help.
Where's Kate? Beckham asked.
In the tunnels. But before we get her, there's something you should know, Ringgold said. As quickly as she could, Ringgold explained the report about Mount Katahdin.
A nuke? How's that possible? He stammered.
How is any of this possible?
Horn said.
The collaborators have been planning for almost 8 years.
Jesus, Beckham said.
Once we get you and the science team out of here, we have to take out that base.
Agreed, Ringgold said. We don't have much time. Now come on. In a matter of minutes, they were descending the stairs into the tunnel where the science team was working. Their escort soldiers and Secret Service agents guided their journey through the humid, webbing-covered tunnels. Ringgold thought over every communication she'd had over the past several hours. They had been careful to encrypt every message, every call. But what if a prying collaborator had intercepted a single message and knew she was here? For that matter, what if collaborator scouts had spotted Beckham arriving? The nuke might take flight any second. Once they rounded another turn in the tunnels, they saw the floodlights where Sergeant Wynne and his men were guarding the science team. The soldiers parted as the president's team approached. Behind them, Ron and Leslie worked behind Sammy and Kate at their computers, all wearing splash suits and respirators. Kate stood at their arrival.
Kate, Beckham said, limping ahead.
She ran to embrace him.
Reed, what are you doing down here?
Evacuating you. We have to leave right now.
What?
Kate looked to Ringgold.
You need to be in splash suits.
No time, Ringgold said. The helicopter is waiting for us. Kate looked back at her team.
We're actually stopping attacks. We can't leave now. We can still save more outposts.
Kate, we have no choice, Beckham said. Pack up your gear and let's go.
There isn't another incoming attack, Kate said. Everything we've intercepted indicated the bats were it.
Kate, the collaborators have a nuke. If they find out about your work or that the president is here, they will turn this place into what I saw in Denver.
Kate stood silently for a second.
It's true, Ringgold said. We can only save more lives if we survive.
Kate finally nodded. Get everything packed up now. Ringgold retreated from the tunnel to wait at the chopper as it was refueled. The shock of this new intel helped expel the exhaustion clouding her. Now a plan began to coalesce. No doubt the collaborators thought they were a step ahead of the Allied States. She planned to prove them wrong. From what Sousa had told her of Mount Katahdin, it was a Cold War-era nuclear weapons facility that was supposed to be top secret. Simply ordering an airborne attack would not guarantee they could stop the nuclear facility buried deep underground. In fact, the base had been built to withstand a nuclear weapons attack, so there was very little they could do with the meager air force they had left. A special forces team that could go in quiet to pull off a surgical strike and sabotage the facility from the inside was a much better option. She turned as Beckham, Horn, and Rico helped Kate and the science team toward the chopper. They were the perfect soldiers for the job.
23.
The Battery Park ball fields were as quiet as a church during Sunday prayer. S.M. Fisher rested in the cabin of the Vibra-sized truck, praying that he would see another Sunday. The seismic monitors glowed across the dashboard, silent. A cold, dry wind curled through the open window and rustled the long, dry grass around the vehicle. It reminded him of those chilly winter nights in the Texas Panhandle. He longed to be back at his ranch, riding through his fields in his pickup, or on a horse to check on his grazing cattle. But those days were almost certainly over.
It's quiet.
Chase said just outside the door. He leaned against the truck, cradling his rifle. Moonlight glowed over the other soldiers guarding the truck.
"I've been praying for the quiet to last the night," Fisher replied to Chase.
"Me too."
A soldier jogged over, and Fisher swung his legs out of the truck. It was Sergeant Dwyer, stopping to do his rounds.
"See anything?"
Dwyer asked.
"Nothing so far," Fisher said.
"Good," Dwyer said. "Only 4 more hours till sunrise. Then I get to thaw my frozen balls."
Chase chuckled.
"I never looked forward to being awake for a sunrise as much as I have over the past few years. Every day we're alive is another to thank God for," Fisher said.
"Yeah, well, tonight I'm thanking you for sticking with us and watching over the outpost," said the sergeant. "We're more grateful than you know."
"It's our privilege," Fisher said, downplaying the man's compliment.
He wasn't one to readily accept high praise.
"This is our home, and these are our families and neighbors," Dwyer continued. "You could have cut and run like the others, but you didn't."
"We're with you till the end," Fisher said. "I just wish I had cigars and whiskey to offer you and the rest of the brave souls out here tonight."
Dwyer smiled, but then his expression turned sour.
"Morale was good until the president left. But we'll make do.
She had no choice. If we lose her and that science team, the war's over."
"Yeah.
We just gotta hold out a little while longer," Chase said.
Fisher didn't want the conversation to sidetrack into something negative, so he checked the vibrosize monitors for good news. The monitors revealed no sign of activity.
"Still nothing," he said. "The science team must have done something remarkable down there."
Dwyer shrugged.
"I've heard too many promises of a cure or a new biological agent to stop the monsters. But every time we launch something like that at the enemy, they come back stronger than before."
His radio crackled, and a voice broke over it.
"Delta One, this is Echo One."
It was Sergeant Wynn, who was now assigned to patrol outside the outpost.
"Go ahead, Echo One, this is Delta One."
Wynn sounded out of breath.
"We spotted contacts, potential hostiles, and they're headed."
Static buzzed over the line.
"Echo One, do you read?"
Dwyer asked. Fisher's heart pounded. Dwyer spoke again, his tone more urgent.
"Echo One, do you read? What's going on?"
Still no response.
"So much for no activity,"
Dwyer said with a grunt. He depressed the call button on his radio.
"All Delta units make ready. Potential hostiles in the area."
Fisher scanned the monitors in the vibersized truck.
"I'm still not seeing anything."
"Maybe it's bats," Chase said, scanning the sky. "I don't see shit," Dwyer said.
Fisher grabbed a pair of binoculars from his dash and searched their surroundings. He checked the sniper nests and then searched the starlit bowl of black above, but saw nothing.
"Anyone got eyes?"
Dwyer asked over the radio. The replies all came back negative. Chase nervously aimed into the distance with his rifle. Men along the barricades stood up at the ready.
"Come on, Echo One,"
Dwyer tried again, pacing next to the truck.
"Tell me."
A crack split the air. Dwyer's face disappeared in a spray of broken bone and blood. His body slumped to the ground, twitching. Fisher stared for a moment, trying to process what had just happened. Everything around him seemed to slow. Adrenaline thundered through his vessels as flashes of gunfire exploded from the rooftops where the snipers were perched. Soldiers on the ground scrambled to take cover from bullets lancing into their positions. Rounds punched into the truck, forcing Fisher down. For a moment, he lay crouched beneath the dash, trying to make sense of things. Had their own snipers turned on them? Were their collaborators in their midst all this time? He snapped from the shock and grabbed his rifle. Carefully, he rose to scope the buildings. He quickly noticed the snipers firing on them were different than the ones he had seen earlier, and the positions where the outpost soldiers had been were dormant. It was then he realized what was happening. The collaborators had infiltrated the buildings, killed the outpost snipers, and were now raining hell down on the field. More bullets slammed into the truck. Cracks spread through the windshield.
"Mr. Fisher," Chase shouted. "I'm okay. Stay down."
Fisher grabbed his radio.
Command, this is Delta 2. We've got hostile contacts hitting our position from everywhere.
Another volley of bullets hit the truck. Smoke hissed out of the hood as rounds punched into the engine block. The smell of oil and burning plastic filled the air.
Get out of there, a voice called in his mind.
It was his wife. The bright glare of rockets flared from a building. Fisher watched them smash into the Bradley fighting vehicles. Balls of fire erupted from the two vehicles, flames billowing from the gaping wounds in their sides. The staccato bark of the machine guns sounded as the outpost soldiers fought back. Tracer rounds cut through the black of night.
Sir, we need to move,
Chase said, yelling above the din. Fisher checked the dashboard. The seismic monitors were still calm, belying the attack outside. They had been so concerned with a variant attack that they hadn't expected collaborators to infiltrate their defensive positions. He considered abandoning the post, but his job was to watch for variant attacks.
Get in here, Fisher said to Chase.
The soldier climbed inside, keeping low.
Sir, all due respect, but what the hell are we doing? We aren't running, that's for sure, Fisher said. Now help me identify some of those targets.
Chase aimed his rifle at the buildings, looking for hostiles. He reported them as he saw the muzzle flashes. Fisher, in turn, reported them over the radio.
Contacts on the sixth floor of the Grayson apartment building.
A wave of tracer rounds sprayed into the windows. The gunfire stopped, but the flash of another rocket flaring from an apartment pierced the dark above the sixth floor. The rocket narrowly missed the Vibersize truck, bursting on the ground and sending up a geyser of dirt. Then came the gunfire. Rounds punched through the metal. The glass shattered, spraying over Fisher. Chase cried out in pain, gripping his thigh as blood pumped between his fingers. Pieces of glass rained down on Fisher as he crawled over to his wounded friend. Chase tried to scoot closer.
Stay down,
Fisher yelled. He reached into one of his vest's pockets, scrounging around for hemostatic bandages.
Move your hand, Fisher said. We gotta stop the bleeding.
Fisher pushed down on the wound. More bullets broke through the door, punching into Chase. In the glow of the dashboard, Fisher saw the wild fear in his friend's eyes. He choked something out, then fell to his side and pinned Fisher down. More rounds hit the truck. Chase's limp body jerked several times as bullets pierced his flesh.
No,
Fisher sobbed. Fisher stayed there for a moment in shock, staring in horror at his dead friend covering him like a human shield.
Get out of there. Run!
The voice of his wife didn't snap him from the shock. It was a bullet to the arm. He used his shoulder to push Chase off and then scooted across the blood-soaked floor of the truck. Fisher tried to push himself against the dashboard, but another round hit his back, slamming him down. Despite the two injuries, he couldn't feel much pain. That was a bad sign. When he tried to move his legs, he realized it was worse than he had thought. The round to his back had hit his spine. This was the end of the road for him. Alarms went off across the dashboard. He tried to crawl back toward it, realization hitting him as hard as those two bullets. The collaborators had softened their defenses, and now the variants were on their way, tunneling underground to finish the outpost off. Fisher struggled to breathe. His mind swam. And he remembered that day before the war, back when he'd first visited President Ringgold to figure out if he would support her in the now suspended elections. He had been hesitant, seeing her as a leader who had ignored the variants. Now he realized he'd been wrong. There was nothing they could have done to prevent this evil. What was happening wasn't her fault. It was the fault of the evil men who had created the monsters. The country was lucky to have a leader like Ringgold to make the tough decisions, to know when to fight, when to retreat, and when to rethink their strategies. Hopefully, she would work with General Cornelius to find a way to beat back the monsters. But the fight for Fisher was over.
Godspeed, Madam President,
he whispered. He crawled over and put a hand on his dead friend. Using his other hand, he pulled out his revolver. His fingers brushed over the words engraved on the barrel. Monster Killer. The alarms in the Vibersize truck blared again, and somewhere in front of the truck, the ground gave way.
Clods of dirt exploded upward, showering the cracked windshield. A demonic shriek erupted from the hole. Fisher repositioned his body just as the door to the truck was ripped off and tossed aside. An ape-like face with milky white eyes looked inside. Ropey muscles bulged across the body of an alpha. Fisher aimed his gun, his shoulders screaming in agony. He pulled the trigger, firing into the creature's chest. It staggered back with each shot, screaming in rage. He fired again and again until the gun clicked empty. Blood poured from the bullet holes in the barreled chest of the beast, but the abominable creature remained standing. It took a step forward, opening a mouthful of fangs. Fisher reached for more bullets in his vest. The alpha took another step, reaching out for him, when it was struck by a bright light. The beast looked to the left, just before it vanished in a blur of metal. Fisher lowered his gun and rested his head on the dashboard. Voices called out among the gunfire. One of them was familiar. Commander Massey climbed inside the cab of the truck. Two men followed, and they carefully picked Fisher up. He was carried to the back of her pickup and gently put into the back of the bed. He lay there, looking up at the dazzling sky, wondering if he had earned a spot up there, or if he would be going to hell.
No hell can be as bad as the one I've experienced here, he thought.
Fisher closed his eyes and let the dark take him. Making progress through the Center for Engineering Complex Organs facility was agonizingly slow for Dohai. Trying to watch his own back while sneaking through a building filled with enemy forces had required every ounce of focus and skill he had developed over the years. So far, there were no clues leading to Fitz and Ace, and he knew he was running out of time. And so were they. He had left a trail of bodies. They were scattered in the tunnel beneath the CECO and in the hallways where he had encountered more chimeras. Dohai increased his pace through a hall, keeping low, hatchet in one hand and suppressed pistol in the other. The facility had once belonged to a normal medical therapeutics company, filled with laboratories, offices, and manufacturing facilities, all lit in a sickly yellow glow from lights pecking out beneath crimson vines covering the walls and ceilings. The pop of variant joints clicked down a corridor, and Dohai shrank into a doorway. Using his shoulder, he nudged open a door with a dirty window to reveal what had once been a large office. While the room wasn't covered in webbing, the stench of sour fruit radiated off the carpet. Blankets and dirty fatigues were strewn on the floor. He tried to adjust the stolen mask from the chimera, but it did little to relieve the putrid smell. Clicking joints grew closer, and with them came grunts and snarls. Dohai knelt next to the door, watching from the side. An elongated shadow moved in front of the window in the door. He pressed himself against a wall, sucking in his breath. The variant paused outside, sniffing the air. Another growl sounded. Dohai tightened his grip on the hatchet. Then he heard a shrill whistle and the gruff voice of a chimera. The variant left the door, scampering down the hall. Dohai watched two more humanoid silhouettes pass by the grimy window. As their footsteps faded, he snuck out into the web-covered hallway. Other doors led to more offices turned into barracks. He tried not to look at the vines covering the walls like spiderwebs, but once again, a memory of being strung up in the webbing sent a cold wave of fear through his bones. Ace and Fitz were probably cocooned in that webbing somewhere. All he had to do was follow the network, and eventually he would find them. Dohai cleared another corridor. This one led to smaller laboratories. Expansive windows provided a look into mostly empty spaces. Microscopes and other equipment rested on lab benches. He didn't see any dust or webbing on them. Someone must still be using them. Voices echoed somewhere behind him. He crept ahead, taking another corner toward a stairwell. The deep voices continued behind him, but there were more coming up the stairwell. Footsteps clanged up the stairs. With no other choice, he retreated to the hall and ducked into a lab. There, he crouched under the windows. The group of soldiers in the hall marched past. Dohai crawled under the shelter of the lab benches. He didn't stop until he got to the back of the room. There were two doors,
One was labeled Chemical Supplies. The other was made of stainless steel and appeared to be a walk-in cooler. Keeping low, he snuck a glance above a lab bench filled with various glass apparatuses. The two separate groups of chimeras had stopped in front of the windows, their backs mostly turned. He ducked back down. Judging by the way their weapons hung loose on their straps and their casual hand gestures, they didn't know he was here. The beasts chatted for another minute. They didn't seem intent on leaving anytime soon. Dohai looked around the lab, just as the walk-in cooler cracked open. A man in a white lab coat started to step out, carrying a box full of supplies. Dohai didn't hesitate. He charged the man, shoving him back inside the walk-in cooler, knocking the box from his hands. Plastic vials spilled across the floor. The door closed shut, sealing them inside. Before the guy could scream, Dohai punched him in the neck. He crumpled into a shelf, knocking off plastic bottles that broke open on the floor. Dohai holstered his pistol and pulled out his knife, bringing it to the man's throat. In the dim light of the walk-in cooler, he saw this was no man. Golden reptilian eyes glistened at him. A flat nose with slitted nostrils sniffled. Scars ran down the length of his face, and an underbite of sharp teeth protruded out of his sucker lips. Dohai pushed his knife against the mutant's throat, trying to make sense of what he was seeing. The beast wasn't dressed like a soldier. He wore a lab coat.
"Where are the prisoners?" Dohai asked.
He pressed the blade deeper until a dribble of blood trickled out.
"Prisoners?"
The mutated scientist seemed confused. Then he took a long sniff, his lips peeling into a snarl.
"I'm only asking you one more time," Dohai said. "You're a dead man."
Dohai rotated the scientist and slammed him against the back wall. This time the creature resisted and turned, snarling. He had no choice but to punch the creature in the face. That did the trick, dropping the hybrid to the ground. Dohai got down, pushing a knee on the scientist's chest to keep him down. Then he pressed his knife against the creature's throat again.
"Try anything else and I'll fillet you," Dohai said.
The creature went limp under his knee, reptilian eyes locked with his. There wasn't the raw anger he had noticed before. There was something else.
"Where are the prisoners?" Dohai entreated.
"There. There. Upstairs. The vivisection labs."
"Vivisection?" Dohai asked.
The scientist managed a nod, blood dripping away from the knife.
"The place where they do the experiments. On us."
Dohai recognized what he saw in those yellow eyes now. Not anger. Fear. Dohai sensed there was no more information he could gain from this man. Interrogation like this only worked if the subject thought there was some hope for them, some chance they might make it out alive. But now the chimera seemed resigned to his fate. He knew death was coming. Dying at Dohai's hands was probably better than at the hands of the wicked people that had made him into a monster. Dohai thought about what he could do. He was sick of killing, sick of hunting, and sick of hiding. Maybe there was another option. Dohai knocked the creature out, then tied him up with supplies he had found inside the cooler. After taping the scientist's mouth shut, he patted him down, withdrawing another key card and ID badge. It wouldn't be long before his handiwork was discovered, and Dohai hurried back to the lab. The chimeras that had been talking outside were gone. He snuck back to the stairwell and took it up a flight of webbing-covered stairs. Idle voices and footsteps echoed in the distance, but they seemed to be coming from below, not above. The next floor stretched out into long corridors. Old signs peeked out from behind the tendrils of red. One read, "Executive Offices." The second read, "Product Testing Facilities." He followed the second sign all the way to a pair of large steel doors secured by a keycard slot. Unlike the other laboratories, this one didn't have glass windows leading into them. From what Dohai knew about buildings like this, that usually meant the company didn't want the average person to see what was going on inside. In the days of medical therapeutics testing, this was where they would hide the animal testing labs. The low growl of voices forced him to shrink into a doorway. Two soldiers on patrol walked down the corridor. He had to figure out a way past them and into those labs, and do it quickly, before the monsters saw or smelled him. He tried to formulate a plan as he hid. But when he heard an all-too-human scream of agony, he clamped up. The scream came again, and Dohai recognized the voice. It was Ace. But it wasn't his normal scream of fear. It sounded like he was being torn apart. 24. Beckham was almost halfway to Mount Katahdin when the primary pilot of their chopper broke the news. Lower Manhattan had fallen. "Did anyone escape?" Rico asked.
"There was an evacuation," replied the pilot. "But they said it happened too fast to save everyone."
Beckham listened to the story of how the collaborators had ambushed the defenses at Battery Park before variants flooded the outpost. His gut clenched at the thought of Fisher and his team being overwhelmed by the enemy forces.
"They must have found out the president and science team were there," Horn said.
Beckham agreed, but he was surprised the collaborators had used ground forces instead of the nuke. Then again, why waste a nuke when your army is so powerful? If the collaborators were saving that nuke, that meant his family was still in danger, and so was the president, no matter where they decided to go. Leaving them back at command had been one of the hardest things Beckham had done. He had hugged Kate for over a minute, praying this wasn't the last time. He did the same thing with Javier. Then Beckham had said the rest of his goodbyes and boarded the Black Hawk with a new primary pilot. Liam joined them as the secondary. Four Marines were also assigned to the mission. They sat in the seats next to Beckham, along with Rico and Horn. In the past, Beckham had known his team well, but the four newcomers were men he had just met. They at least looked rested, which was more than Beckham, Rico, and Horn could say. The operators had been on the move for the past 2 days, only grabbing brief reprieves here and there. Beckham was used to fighting exhausted, but this was different. He was almost a decade older, and his body was battered. He couldn't see well out of his right eye, and the new prosthetic leg they had grabbed at the bunker wasn't properly fitted.
"All it takes is all you got," he thought.
"It's on us now," Beckham said. "We can't fail."
They went over the plan. Two more teams would carry out their own strikes on Katahdin to ensure better odds of success. Each team was a fail-safe in case any of the others were killed or captured. The only intel they had on the site was an old Cold War map that General Sousa had scrounged up from classified archives. Beckham held it up and searched for insertion points. There were multiple ways into the base, which meant they would have to split up.
"We're passing Boston now," Liam said.
Putting the map aside, Beckham turned to look out the window. A huge section of the city burned on the horizon. Another outpost, utterly wiped out. Anger boiled inside of him as he watched the flames. Nearly an hour later, when they flew past Portland, that anger boiled over into unbridled fury. Remembering his former life, the peace they had for 8 years, it was almost too much. The variants and their human allies had returned like a cancer with an insatiable appetite, killing everything in their path.
10 minutes to LZ, said Liam.
The other two strike teams have landed, said the primary pilot.
Rico bowed her head. She hadn't said much for the past hour, but Beckham knew she was worrying about more than this raid. Fitz was still out west with Dohai and Ace. So far, no one had heard anything from them. He looked at his watch. 3 in the morning.
"This may be the most important mission of our life," Beckham said. "And I don't say that lightly."
He paused to sweep his gaze over the warriors in front of him.
"No mistakes. We keep it tight and fast," Beckham said.
"And we send these assholes to hell," Horn added.
"Hoorah,"
said the Marine sergeant. The other Marines finished checking their NVGs and gear and began loading their weapons.
"Horn, you got point. Rico, rear guard," Beckham said. "Radio silent from here on out. We'll meet at the blast doors. Watch for traps and sensors."
Horn pulled his skull bandana up over his mouth and tied it behind his head. Beckham snapped his NVGs down. The bird lowered over the forest, whipping the branches of the pine trees.
"Looks good," said the primary pilot.
Rico placed the braided rope onto the hook. One by one, the Marines and soldiers fast roped to the bed of pine needles below. Beckham was the last to go.
"Good luck,"
Liam said. Beckham nodded at his new friend, then slid out into the cold early morning. The chopper pulled up and disappeared over the trees. They would put down and wait until the mission was complete. The Marines spread out, heading east to ensure if one team was ambushed, another might have a chance, in addition to the other two teams that had landed in other locations. Horn led the way, and Beckham scanned the black and green hue of his night vision. He searched the pine trees and ferns growing along the base of the mountain that could hide snipers or other traps. Horn moved fast, his saw roving for targets. Beckham alternated between his NVGs and the thermal detection on his M4A1. Every time they paused, he flipped up his NVGs and scanned for heat signatures. It might not pick up the beasts if they had thermally camouflaged themselves, but it would pick up any collaborators. Horn started up a hill, keeping low. Beckham went next, and Rico followed close behind. At the crest, they moved out in combat intervals through a forest. Beckham held up a hand, then stopped to scan their surroundings. Sure enough, there was a heat signature in the rocks. Someone was lying prone on a ledge. He motioned to the outcropping. Rico and Horn took cover. Beckham kept his scope up as he searched for a better vantage, making sure the sniper didn't move. Finding a rock cluster of his own, he aimed at the suspected collaborator. If he missed, the sniper would sound an alarm. He was only going to get one chance. Lining up the sights, he held his breath and then squeezed the trigger. The body of his target jerked, then went still. Beckham sighed with relief. Horn and Rico fell in line with him, and they worked their way up another hill. Halfway up, Beckham heard footsteps over the rustle of the wind through the trees. He searched for heat signatures but saw nothing. Maybe it was just in his mind. As they advanced, loose rocks and mud made progress difficult, but the new blade, uncomfortable as it was, still performed better than the improvised junk prosthetic they had put together on the last mission. He balled his hand when he saw movement ahead. A look through his scope confirmed the heat signatures of two men patrolling a path. Beckham, Horn, and Rico slipped off the side of the path and into the trees to flank the collaborators. When he was in position, Horn burst onto the trail, tackling one of the men into the brush. Rico took her knife to the other man's throat, sawing his neck open. Beckham spotted a third soldier further down the trail and fired a suppressed burst into his chest. The team pulled the corpses off the path before continuing up the trail. A few minutes later, they came to a clearing where they spotted an A-86 Little Bird helicopter. Beckham took cover behind the brush on a side of the clearing with a road leading right through a set of open blast doors. This was their target. He scoped out the area, but saw nothing. Had the Marines already beat him here? Cautiously, he started toward the blast doors with Rico and Horn flanking him. When they reached the tunnel, they found spent shell casings littering the ground and the scent of cordite drifting through the wide corridor. But there was no sign of the Marines or any hostiles. Maybe one of their other teams had reached this place first and engaged the collaborator guards. Horn took the lead with his saw down a passage wide enough for a truck. Overhead lights guided them to another smaller door that had been left open. They cleared the tunnel and entered a narrow concrete corridor. An intersection gave them two options. Beckham paused to get his bearings. The missile silo would be further from the mountain where the ground was flatter. He headed down the left passage that he thought would take them away from the mountain. They didn't find any guards, which made Beckham uneasy. If the Marines or one of the other teams were inside, then the collaborators knew they were here. Their cover might already be blown. A trail of blood supported that theory. Beckham increased his pace. The concrete tunnels led to more doors. He didn't bother trying to clear the rooms. They didn't have time. With no signs pointing to a nuclear silo or any other leads,
Horn simply followed the blood. The trail continued around a corner until it stopped outside an open door to another chamber. Moonlight streamed through an open roof. Beckham could smell the forest and something else. The stench of death. Rifle up, he slowly entered. Another step and he stopped to flip up his NVGs. Cast in moonlight were bodies centered in the concrete chamber. Not bodies. Pieces of bodies. The Marines, he realized. The men were nothing but shreds of ragged flesh and bones. He only recognized them because of their scattered weapons. A growl sounded, and Beckham turned to look for the monsters when a beast knocked him to the ground. Horn and Rico fired, blasting two men before a group of collaborators in black fatigues overwhelmed them from the shadows. Beckham tried to push himself up, but his captor pressed down on his back. He twisted to try and grab the neck of the variant. But it wasn't a monster. Not fully. This creature was half variant, half man. The beast held a saw-toothed cutlass to Beckham's neck and snarled. The scarred face was similar to the corpses he had seen in Denver, and just like the ones Team Ghost had reported on the West Coast. Chimeras, Ghost had called them. They weren't alone. Two actual men walked over, one with dreadlocks and the other with a thick beard. The guy with dreads knelt in front of Beckham with a smile. The monster with the cutlass applied pressure, drawing blood as the blade bit into Beckham's neck.
"Holy shit," the dreadlocked man said. "You're Captain Reed Beckham, aren't you? I wasn't expecting to see you, but I should have known."
Beckham looked for a way out, but there were four of the chimeras. Rico and Horn were already pinned against a wall. A fifth beast writhed on the ground, groaning, but still alive. Only one of the creatures was dead from a bullet to the skull.
"Get him up," said the man in front of Beckham.
Beckham was yanked up by his captor and joined his friends against the wall. For the first time since they had entered, he got a good look at his surroundings. Other prisoners were trapped by variant glue across the room, but most appeared to be dead. Only a few other soldiers fought against their organic restraints. They had to be the other teams Ringgold had sent.
"I'd like to introduce you to someone," said the guy with dreads.
He gestured to a shadowed corner where blood had pooled out into the moonlight. Out of the black strode an alpha bigger than Horn. Blood dripped out of the corners of its elongated jaw. The beast approached slowly. Black eyes flashed yellow as they roved from Beckham to Horn and then to Rico. The monster went to her first and licked his lips with a lizard-like tongue.
"Beautiful,"
he said in a gravelly voice. Spittle and blood painted her face as he breathed in and out with deep gasps. The abomination of nature leaned closer, its jaw widening. As the lips parted, the gums burst open like a blooming flower. But this was no flower. The fleshy petals were rigid in tiny, sharp teeth. Hundreds of them. Rico squirmed, trying to get away.
"Our general likes females the best," said the man with dreads. "They taste better."
Horn broke away from his captors, throwing one to the ground. He rushed the general. A chimera slammed into him before he could get close. They hit the ground, rolling, while Beckham and Rico shouted. Horn managed to knock the beast out with an elbow to the head. As soon as he got up, a second chimera tackled him. Then a third helped hold him down. The alpha remained next to Rico, licking its lips. Long webs of saliva stretched across the red petal-like gums. Beckham fought against his restraints, his veins and eyes bulging as he tried to get free.
"Horn!" he screamed.
Rico shouted and squirmed too, trying to get away from those sharp red petals, but none of it mattered. There weren't any allies left to hear their screams. Beckham hadn't led his team to the nuclear silo. He had led them straight to a feeding chamber. He watched in horror as the alpha leaned in to feast on Rico. She twisted and tried to pull back, whimpering in agony. The petals opened wider as it prepared to clamp down on her face. But the beast suddenly tilted his head, ears perking. It looked toward the opening in the ceiling, sniffing the air through slitted nostrils. All of the meaty flaps, covered in teeth, retracted. The Alpha snarled at Rico, then directed its wild eyes at the collaborators. The beast growled.
"We're not alone,"
he said.
"Send out the thralls."
Fitz lay naked on the cold surface of a surgical table, his arms buckled in place by metal clasps. On an adjacent table, Ace was also secured. His naked body was bruised and swollen from the torture they had endured. Blood dribbled from his busted nose. Fitz moved his head just enough to see a few other bodies on surgical tables. But these were not men. They were chimeras with gray flesh and clawed hands. Each one long dead, their bodies cut open to reveal glistening insides. The door to the macabre operating room opened, and footsteps echoed through the space. Lloyd walked up to Fitz.
"I think we'll start with this one. Get over here, Corin," said the scientist.
Someone else joined Lloyd. As Fitz strained to see the assistant, he noticed Corin wasn't a man. Reptilian eyes peeked over a surgical mask, half variant and half human. A chimera, just like the dead specimens scattered on the other tables. In clawed hands, he carried a scalpel and a drill. Ace bucked against his restraints, grumbling and cursing. Lloyd peered over his surgical mask at Fitz. He tapped a syringe filled with a clear liquid.
"What is that?"
Fitz asked. Lloyd grinned his yellow smile.
"An improvement to VX-99. The first of many doses."
He set down the syringe on a metal tray next to the table and took a scalpel from Corin.
"We found the process works faster if we can replace some of your organs with those of an evolved variant," Lloyd said.
"Primes the pump, if you will."
"It won't work on me," Fitz said. "I'll never fight for the new gods."
Lloyd laughed.
"Corin thought he was a rebel once, too. Now look at him."
Corin said nothing. He just stared blankly at Fitz with those yellow eyes.
"Our formulation, we like to call it VX-102, ensures the neurological changes you'll experience are just enough to keep you from retaining any self-will. Most importantly, you'll become the perfect predator Colonel Gibson tried to create all those decades ago in Vietnam with Lieutenant Brett."
"Don't," Ace said. He let out a long groan. "Don't hurt, Fitz."
Lloyd walked over and put a gloved hand on Ace.
"You'll make a good soldier for the new gods, too. But it's the cripple's turn first."
He returned to Fitz and picked up the scalpel again.
"We can make you whole again."
He glanced at Fitz's thighs.
"Do you want that?"
"I'm not broken," Fitz said. "I've always been whole, and I'll fight for the Allied."
Lloyd pressed the scalpel against Fitz's chest without warning. The scorching electricity of every breaking nerve ripped through his body, and he let out a long howl of pain.
"No!"
Ace shouted. He squirmed back and forth, rocking the table slightly. Lloyd handed the bloody scalpel to Corin. Wincing, Fitz glanced down to see a red line where Lloyd had started the first incision. Blood started to spread over his chest. Lloyd had promised to keep them awake throughout the surgery, saying it would help him keep tabs on their mental status as he applied his diabolical treatments. Now Fitz found himself wishing to be back in the webbing, being pulled apart instead of cut apart. In seconds, Lloyd would start tearing his organs from his body. Suddenly, muffled sounds and a bang against the door to the operating room broke Lloyd's focus. The crazy scientist furrowed his brow, then turned toward the door.
"What's that all about?" he asked. "Distracting from our experiments again. Those Neander—"
The door burst open before he could finish his sentence, and two chimeras strode in wearing dirty fatigues covered in blood. One of the mutant soldiers held the other hostage with a pistol. Fitz tried to understand what was going on. Apparently, he wasn't the only one confused.
"What are you doing?" Lloyd asked.
This is authorized access only. And you?
The soldier fired, and the hostage crumpled from a bullet to the skull. Then the soldier aimed the smoking gun barrel at Lloyd.
Stop this! Screamed the scientist, holding up his hands. You must stop!
The soldier fired. A bullet punched into Lloyd's upper chest. He looked down in shock as blood blossomed in the neat hole. He put a hand over the wound and looked up at the chimera. The creature fired again. Lloyd fell back against the wall, sliding down, blood streaking down the clean white. His wild blue and brown eyes lowered as he wheezed. Then the gun went to Corin.
Patch them up now, said the soldier.
Corin hesitated. The chimera pulled off his mask to reveal his face. It was Dohai.
You made it, Fitz stammered.
Corin still didn't move.
Patch them up, Dohai commanded again.
The beastman finally moved to a cabinet. Then he went to work on Fitz with surgical glue, quickly closing up the cut. Fitz blinked through the exhaustion and shock, his battered body aching everywhere as the chimera cleaned him up. Dohai watched, holding a gun to Corin's head.
Get me out of here, Ace grumbled. Hold up, Dohai said.
You'll never escape, crackled a voice.
It was Lloyd, somehow still alive.
We will, but you won't, Dohai said.
Lloyd chuckled and then started coughing.
The new gods have already won, Lloyd said. This land is theirs.
While keeping the gun trained on Corin, Dohai went over to Ace and undid the restraints. Ace was slow to move, but he managed to sit up, his naked body trembling. Dohai withdrew a syringe.
You're going to need this.
What is it?
Ace asked.
Adrenaline.
He jabbed the needle into Ace and depressed the plunger. The big operator gasped and gripped his chest. While he recovered, Dohai gave Fitz another shot. Then he told Corin to follow him into the hall. Ace stumbled over to pick up a drill while Fitz sat up on the table. The scientist looked at both of them in turn.
Ah, man, I've been waiting for this, Ace said.
He limped to Lloyd and kicked him with a naked foot. In his weakened state, Ace couldn't even summon enough strength to knock the dying man over from his position against the wall. Lloyd merely huffed, his skin growing paler.
This war is already over. The Master will.
As long as I'm still alive, it ain't, Ace said.
He bent down, grimacing, then drilled a hole through Lloyd's ear as he screamed. The sound lasted for a few moments before he finally went limp. Corin and Dohai returned with some of the gear and clothing Ghost had brought on the mission. Best of all, they had prosthetics Fitz would need to get out of this place. Dohai simply stared at Ace.
What? Ace said. Nothing.
Dohai helped Fitz put on the prosthetics and then helped him off the table.
How do we get out of here? Fitz asked. There's a garage, Dohai said. Our new friend Corin is taking us there.
The beast glanced at Fitz with yellow eyes, but then looked away sheepishly. He didn't protest or exhibit the brutal aggression the other chimeras did. He seemed more like a slave instead of a soldier. Fitz glanced down at Lloyd's body on the floor before they left. Blood drizzled out of his ear. Dohai led the small group into the hall where he switched his handgun for the suppressed M4 slung over his vest. Blood pooled over the floor from the chimeras Dohai had already dispatched in the corridor. Fitz grabbed an MP5 off one and extra magazines. Ace found an AK-47 and loaded up on ammo. They were both in bad shape and plodded along slowly. Fitz did everything he could to stay focused, but even with the adrenaline, it was rough. His laceration felt like it would split with the gentlest exertion, and the bruises across his body burned with even the most careful movements. Dohai opened a door and swept his rifle over the landing and stairs.
Clear, he said.
They went down the stairwell. By the time they reached the bottom, Fitz gasped for air. Each breath set his lungs on fire again, his ribs throbbing with pain.
Already he could feel the temporary bandages over his chest working free. Blood started to drip into his fatigues. The howl of a variant took his mind away from the pain. Dohai looked back to Corin.
Which way to the garage?
The beast growled out the directions. Dohai aimed his gun at Corin's face.
You telling the truth?
Fitz squinted at Corin, trying to figure out if the half-man behind those monstrous features was walking them right into a trap.
Dr. Lloyd was lying to you, Corin said. My mind isn't theirs. They took me as a slave. They threatened to turn my family into monsters like this, too, if I didn't help.
Collaborators lie all the fucking time, Dohai said.
Fine. Kill me,
Corin said.
It's better than living like this. Like an experiment.
Howls and shrieks of more variants echoed into the stairwell.
Lead us to the garage, Fitz said.
Dohai kept going down the stairs until they reached a door that opened to the parking garage Corin had promised. Two Humvees with National Guard logos on the sides were parked here. A pickup truck and two sedans were next to them between concrete columns. At the other end of the garage, a ramp with a gate arm across it led directly to the alley behind CECO. Four chimeras stood guard outside, hardly visible.
Quiet and quick, Fitz said.
They snuck through the garage, hiding behind the pillars until they reached the first Humvee. Unlike most in-service military vehicles, this one didn't have a cable wrapped around the steering wheel to lock it in place. Fitz helped Ace into the back of the vehicle, and Dohai stuffed Corin in next to Ace.
You're coming as insurance, Dohai said. Ace, keep him secured.
All right,
Ace mumbled. Fitz looked through the windshield at the four guards standing at the exit. All they had to do was get past them and then drive to the boat in the cove. If they made it to Marrowstone, they would be free, ready for pickup by the Canadians.
All it takes is all you got, Fitz thought to himself.
He didn't have much left, but he did have something. The will to survive and the heart to keep fighting so he could see Rico again. With a flip of the ignition switch, the engine roared to life. The four chimeras at the exit swiveled, throwing their hands up to shield their eyes from the headlights. Fitz mashed the pedal and the big tire